Welcome to the Barnes Review History Hour. This is your host, John Friend. Today is Tuesday, August 2nd, 2022. The Barnes Review History Hour is a program where I will be interviewing contributors to the Barnes Review History Magazine, a bi-monthly print and digital publication dedicated to bringing history into accord with the facts, as well as other special guests. Please do consider subscribing to the Barnes Review if you are not already. Check out barnesreview.org for all the details. And today I am joined by Remy Tremblay, a French-Canadian journalist, editor, author, and a regular contributor to the Barnes Review. Okay, Remy Tremblay, welcome back to the TBR History Hour. How have you been, sir?
Well, I'm doing fine. Thank you for inviting me once again. It was a pleasure last time, and it is an honor once again to be with you tonight.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah, I appreciate it. You were last on the program on May 5th, and that was your first appearance here. And it was actually the first time that we had ever spoken. I've been following your work in the Barnes Review for a long time now. And the last interview we did was on May 5th. You can find that on the Barnes Review website, barnesreview.org. And I'm just curious, like, what have you been up to since then? It's been almost 3 months, so I'm just curious, what have you been up to? I know you've been writing for the Barnes Review. You've also contributed a couple articles to American Free Press since the last time we've spoken. What else have you been up to?
Well, of course, the fact that I'm publishing a news magazine here takes a lot of my time. But my biggest project right now is still working on the book about the history of the racialist movement within the United States since the Second World War. It's taking a lot of time to compile, read, research. And I'm actually almost done with the first volume of the three-volume set, which should be published later this year in France, if everything goes well. The first volume, at least.
Awesome. Wow, you definitely got your work cut out for you, especially if it's going to be a multi-volume series. So that's awesome. That's really interesting. That sounds like, obviously, a topic that listeners are going to be very much interested in and looking forward to reading about. Now, you are an independent journalist, an editor, an author, and of course, as I mentioned, a regular contributor to the Barnes Review, which is the bi-monthly history magazine dedicated to bringing history into accord with the facts in the tradition of Dr. Harry Elmer Barnes. And the July-August 2022 edition of the magazine was mailed out about 3 weeks ago, so all subscribers should have their copy. You wrote a very interesting article about Robert Dupuig, an American dissident and a skeptic that founded the Minutemen organization, which basically sort of kickstarted what we know today as the militia movement or the survivalist movement. And Dupuig actually knew the late Willis Cardo, who founded the Barnes Review back in 1994. Willis Cardo was the legendary nationalist publisher and organizer. And I actually wrote a review of a book that was written about him called Willis Cardo and the American Far Right, which was written by a mainstream political scientist named George Michael. And in that book, I remember him specifically talking about Willis Cardo's relationship with Dupuig and many other figures in the quote-unquote far right over the years. So I thought that was very interesting. And before we jump into your article, because I do want to focus much of our conversation on your actual article, I want to just give everybody a brief overview of some of the articles that were published in this most recent edition of the magazine. And the lead article was actually written by Mark Rowland, and it's called The South's Rothschild Agent. And it deals with the history of Judah P. Benjamin, who was one of the most high-ranking officials in the Confederate government. And, of course, he was a Jewish individual. A lot of intrigue surrounding Judah P. Benjamin. Lots of rumors over the years. And this was a fascinating article, and it was like the feature of this most recent edition of the magazine. We also had an article by Mark Anderson, who's a regular contributor to American Free Press. He wrote a very interesting profile of William Eberhardt, who was also another Canadian sort of populist, nationalist-type figure, who worked in the Canadian government, I believe, leading up to and during World War II. A very interesting profile of this monetary populist. And then, of course, we had your article dealing with Robert De Puig and the origins of the modern militia movement. John Weir had a number of articles published in this edition, including one dealing with the Jewish involvement in the communist revolution. He also had an article dealing with Albert Einstein, wondering whether he was actually a genius or was he a fraud, as some dissidents have alleged over the years. And he also wrote an article dealing with the Western Allies' demand of unconditional surrender by Germany at the end of World War II and sort of what that led to. There was also an article by Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson dealing with Tibet and its historical relationship with Russia and also with China to a certain extent. Very interesting topic. I did an interview with Henry Herskovitz and his battle for free speech, and this is a very interesting individual. He's an activist of, he's actually of Jewish ethnic background, you know, has a Jewish ethnic background, but he's become a major critic of Israel and of Zionism and of Jewish power and influence in the United States and really around the world. And he has openly dealt with very controversial topics relating to World War II and 9/11 and many other issues. So we had a very interesting sort of Q&A written interview published in this most recent edition of the magazine. And then finally, there was one other article dealing with the infiltration and subversion of the Catholic Church by a first-time TBR contributor known as Mike Maines. So very interesting topics, of course, that the Barnes Review covers in every issue. And that is just a sampling of some of the topics that we cover. Of course, I encourage listeners to subscribe to the magazine if they do not already. Of course, you can check out barnesreview.org for all of the details. Remy, I don't know if you had any comments about some of the very interesting topics that the Barnes Review covered in this most recently published issue, or just in general, if you had any comments about the magazine.
Well, it is always a great magazine. I must admit that Mark Anderson's article really touched a topic we never discussed, and it is like alternatives to the monetary system. And I think he made a great point about social credit by presenting one of its foremost advocates in Canada. It was a big movement in Canada, and nobody talks about like monetary alternatives anymore. And I think it is extremely important that we look for a third way. We're not stuck in the monetary system. It is not something we cannot change. And this is something that Mark Anderson really points out in his article. And I think it is a must read.
Yeah, exactly. I couldn't agree with you more. And it's extremely relevant, you know, when we're looking at rising inflation across the Western world, particularly here in America, when we're looking at, you know, rising debts, rising energy prices. Gas prices in the United States are at historic levels. It's probably even worse in Western Europe, I would imagine. I understand just energy costs in general, whether it's, you know, coal for heating your home or natural gas or whatever, everything is just through the roof. And, you know, as Anderson points out in this article, dealing with William Eberhardt, there is a third way. There is an alternative to this debt-based system. And it's something that, you know, champions like William Eberhardt has sort of brought out and tried to implement some of these policies historically. But, you know, we basically don't hear anything about it, you know, in a modern context. And it's something that's very, very important and very relevant, you know, when we see the economic crisis spiraling out of control across the Western world, really. And much of it is totally self-inflicted, frankly.
Yes, and I mean, it's something that most populists don't talk about anymore. I mean, populists will talk about like immigration, mass immigration, because it's the first thing that we see. But if we want to get to the root causes, and if we want to go deeper, I think it is important that we have a larger, a broader overview of the problems we face and of the different solutions. Social credit is one, but there are other alternatives as well. We just need to like continue like thinking about all that. And we need to stop, you know, like, focusing on simple, like single issues. We need to look at a broader picture, and I think Anderson has opened a few doors with his article.
Right, yeah, I agree. And that's really something the Barnes Review does in every issue. You know, talking about some of these historical issues from a very politically incorrect perspective, so to say. I mean, you won't find a lot of these ideas and a lot of this information presented, certainly not in the mainstream. And it's very, very important to have an accurate historical understanding, a proper understanding of our history, if we want to find solutions in our modern age. And that's something I've always felt very strongly about. And again, the Barnes Review is sort of dedicated to doing just that. So with that said, I want to definitely focus on your article dealing with Robert De Puig. And you begin the article by kind of discussing the origins of the survivalist, or like the prepper movement, sometimes it's known as. You know, you see a lot of like prepper YouTube channels. And some of these channels are huge. I mean, they have, you know, hundreds of thousands of subscribers. So can you maybe, to get started, can you talk about why these sorts of skills and, you know, this sort of just mindset in general, like prepping, preparing for the future, preparing for a potential, you know, catastrophe or a supply chain disruption, which we've seen in recent years, obviously. Can you kind of talk about why these sorts of skills and this sort of mindset might be so relevant in our modern age today?
Well, actually, it's something that's been going, like, it has been floating around for quite a few years. The prepper movement is not something new, but with the COVID pandemics and how the government reacted, a lot, and like the shortages that came after, a lot of people decided to become like more autonomous, more independent from the state, from the businesses and everything. The more self-reliant you're going to be, basically, is the point. The less dependent you'll be and the more chances of success and survival you have. Now, the question is not like about going into the woods and hunting bears or trying to run after like feral agents or something like that. Basically, it's to be self-reliant at home, to be independent from the rest. If anything goes wrong, you're going to be able to survive without the Walmart, without the state to help you. So I think it's a quest for self-reliance. It is basically what that is. There has been a lot of people like stereotyping those people as like stockpiling weapons or stockpiling canned food. But basically, most of the preppers that I have met are really interested in knowledge, how to grow food, how to hunt, how to use resources around, how you can collect like safe water, how you can heal from wounds, how you can use plants to heal, things like this. It's basically going back to a knowledge that will give you the chance to survive if anything goes wrong. Now, of course, a lot of people have made fun of the preppers, like talking about, but, well, you know, insinuating they were scared of zombies or anything like that. But we have seen that the world as we know it may not be as strong and as solid as it seems. With the pandemics, a lot of products went missing. A lot of, well, you know, the government was not able to fulfill its so-called mission to protect and serve and provide for everybody. Well, this is how it's seen in Quebec. Of course, in the United States, the mission of the government is more limited. But here, a lot of people rely on the government. So with that being said, a lot of people have been to, like, just realize that they were totally reliant on the rest of society. They could not like survive on their own. This is, I think, one of the biggest reasons why in the past 2 years there has been a surge in the prepper movement, a survivalist movement. It's not fueled by any paranoiac ideas or a conspiracy theory. It really is a desire to be able to survive on your own. And I think it's pretty sane when you think about it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, especially considering what we've seen over the course of the past 2 years with the systematic and I would argue planned disruption of the supply chain of the whole entire global economy. That's really, I think, what has led to all this inflation and all these other economic problems. At least that's the primary reason. Dr. Paul Craig Roberts has been writing pretty extensively about this, and I think he makes a good argument that this is the main reason why we see inflation today is because of the government's response to this alleged COVID pandemic, which was to shut down the economy, disrupt all these supply chains, totally artificial, totally imposed by the government. It wasn't something that happened naturally. And this is what's led to all the problems we see today. And I think it really shows people that, you know, if you're in a position where you are relying on the government or just relying on the broader society in general for your every need, you are in a really, really tough position, a really precarious position, right? Because we've seen how easy it is to disrupt the, you know, the entire system with, you know, a couple executive orders, you know, and especially when these sorts of policies are coordinated as they are across the entire Western world, you know, it leads to all sorts of problems, which we see manifest very, very obviously today, right?
Yeah, and I mean, the first hard, like, confinement in Quebec was 2 weeks. Basically, like, you cannot do anything for 2 weeks, you cannot go out or anything like that. And I mean, like, a lot of people were not, like, not surviving 2 weeks without going to the store or without you know, going to larger chains. They could not do it on their own. And I'm talking about, like, surviving for two, no more than that. And it was impossible for most. We have seen, like, a toilet paper rush, just like in the gold rush of the 1900s. I mean, like, people were rushing to get toilet paper, canned food, and nobody had thought that this would be possible, that one day the shelves could be empty, that one day they could not just go to the store, use their credit card, and get whatever they wanted. So they realized that the society and so-called, like, supply chain could actually fail them. And what we have seen, like, during the last 2 years is, like you said, an increase in problems with supply chain. And it is not going to, I think it's going to be there for a while. It might even increase in the next few years.
Yeah, yeah, no, I think you're right. I think when you implement these sorts of policies that have totally disrupted the entire global economy, it's going to take some time before things are sorted out. And I don't think, you know, some of the rhetoric we see from our political leaders, whether it's in Canada or the United States or other Western European countries, helps the matter by any means. And certainly what we're seeing with Russia and all the economic sanctions, you know, this is not conducive to, you know, the restart of the global economy. And frankly, I think you'd be extremely naive and foolish to even want to participate in a system like that. You should have some skills where you could survive off the grid for a couple weeks if you had to. I think that's extremely important, and I think it's you know, it's something that is obviously making a comeback, and you know, it's a totally rational, legitimate perspective to hold considering what we've seen over the course of the past 2 years. So,
and yeah, I totally agree with that. And this is a new problem, like I'm pointing it out in my article. I mean, like, A few generations ago, people did not need to be in a prepper movement or in a survivalist movement. For the very basic reason, everybody was, like, kind of self-reliant. People had the skill to survive. They knew how to hunt. They knew how to, well, I'm talking mostly about people in the countryside, of course, but they were able to survive on their own. They were, self-reliant to a certain extent. They were not dependent on electricity, on their smartphone or anything like that. I mean, because we have become, like, dependent and reliant on society at large, this is why there's a need to become self-reliant again. And now right. It needs to be done in a way that is explicit, while our ancestors did not need to do it, like, explicitly. It was implicit. Everybody was able to survive, and the people who were reliant were generally the kids or older people.
Right, yeah. Yeah, well said. I agree with you. Well, let's jump into Dupuig and his background. From what I understand, he served in the army, and this would have been during World War II. And after that, he worked as a salesman before he established his own company called Biolabs, which sold veterinary products as well as health supplements, correct? It was sort of like a health supplement type company. Which again, yeah, dovetails with the whole survivalist type mindset, right?
Yeah, and from what I understood, it is still around. I've been trying to find it, but apparently it does. It's still running, but I haven't been able to, like, prove it or disprove that point.
Okay. Yeah. Well, if it's not still around, there's plenty of companies that have taken his initiative and started their own very successful supplemental type companies. And his business ended up, from what I understand, originally he sort of struggled as a businessman, but eventually the business became very successful, correct?
Yeah, it did. And yep, and it is when it became like very successful that he managed to have more time to get involved into politics. And, you know, he was not trying to like earn his living anymore. He had enough money to be able to like think about other things, such as how society was run, politics, and things like this.
Right, yeah. And so this would have been post-World War II, obviously, when he became sort of radicalized. And I don't even really like that term. Basically, what I mean by that is that he simply woke up, as everyone listening to this interview probably has at some point, you know, to the reality that our government and media are lying about virtually everything. And in his day, he joined the John Birch Society. That was like sort of his first political involvement, right? And, he became extremely concerned, rightfully so, looking back on it, you know, historically. He became extremely concerned about the threat of international communism, whose agents had, in fact, actually firmly entrenched themselves within the United States government, in academia, in the media, and in other important sectors of society. And this is certainly true under the FDR administration during World War II. There has been a plethora of information that has come out documenting that many of the people involved in the FDR administration at the highest levels were outright communist agents. Some of them were merely sympathizers of the communist cause, but many of them were, in fact, outright agents of the Soviet Union. And so this sort of like fear that John Birchers and other anti-communists had of the threat of communism was actually very real. It wasn't some crazy, kooky conspiracy theory. It actually was a real threat facing the country.
Oh, yeah. And actually, I would say at the beginning of the whole like involvement of the Puig, well, the reasoning was, if ever there is a communist army like invading us, what are we going to do? Are we just going to lose? Are we going to rely on the army? Or are we going to be able to do the same thing as they have done like in other countries? Are we going to be able to go on the ground and fight back? Are we going to be able to resist? And he got inspiration from communist fighters like who resisted like non-communist interventions in other countries. So he thought with friends, well, if ever there's a takeover, we need to be ready to go on the ground and fight back the invaders. And that was the first, like, his first point. We need to be able to build a network of resistance. Now, if ever there's an invasion, it's going to be too late to think about it. So he decided with a few friends that, hey, we should get ready for that eventuality. And I mean, like, Cuba was turning communist at that time. There was a great turmoil. The world was in turmoil at that time. The Cold War was at its high point. So it was not something paranoiac or paranoid. It was a very, very real threat. And like he said, there were a lot of communist supporters within the administration and within the United States. So you cannot rely on those people to like build an underground that would be able to defend the United States in case of an enemy invasion. So this is how it started as a future resistance movement.
So his basic mindset was that he simply did not trust the institutions in the United States. If there were a communist invasion or communist uprising or just, you know, maybe a catastrophe or a collapse of society, he just simply didn't trust the institutions and wanted, and his mindset was, look, we need to rely on each other. We need to be proactive and form small local cells to actually be able to resist, to actually be able to fend for ourselves, you know, should something like this happen. And from what I understand, they were basically training and preparing for this sort of scenario and organizing themselves into small local cells, which I think they were mostly focused on, like small arms training and survival skills, right? I mean, that was the gist of it, essentially.
Yeah, exactly. They took example on what happened in France during the German invasion, after the German invasion. I mean, like, France was not ready to wage a war against Germany in 1940, and they lost. Once your country is occupied, it is extremely difficult to network and to be able to, set sails and set a resistance. So this is a resistance network. So this is exactly what we were preparing, what they had in mind. And basically, a resistance network won't have access to tanks or to big weapons, because everything's going to have to go to be underground, to be hidden. So they were training with small, exactly like you said, small arms, in case of a guerrilla, in case they needed to fight as a guerrilla against an invading army. That was the first mindset, I would say.
Right. Yeah. And over the course of his lifetime, he actually published a few books, including one titled Blueprint for Victory, another titled Can You Survive, and then a third one called Principles of Guerrilla Warfare, which is pretty interesting. I could see how that that last book would sort of put him on the radar of the federal government, and I could see why they would take an active interest in his organization and his activities, which they certainly ended up doing, right? I mean, the FBI was very much concerned about the Minutemen and other right-wing groups at the time as well, but especially his sort of organization, where they were, again, actively training and we'll get into – I have another question about, some of the criminal acts they were alleged to have carried out. We'll get into that in just a minute. But I guess what I'm saying is I could understand why the federal government would take an active interest in this sort of organization. Did you read any of his books in preparation for the article? I'm just curious. I've never read any of them. I'm just – they sound interesting, but I'm just curious if you read any of them and what your thoughts are.
Well, I sure did. I actually read the three of them. It is a part of my preparation for the book I'm writing, and I mentioned earlier on. So I did read the three of them. And basically, the last two you mentioned, except for Blueprint for Victory, about Can You Survive, is really about his experience, like, in the desert, how the tricks to how to survive in the wild. So basically, what water, how you should treat water before drinking it, and what you can eat, if you've got eye problems, what you can do to fix this while you're in the wild. It really is like an interesting book from a survivalist point of view. Guerrilla warfare is pretty much in the same vein, except that it is a more collective book. If ever you're under an occupied government, if ever there's an occupation force, an invading army, how can you wage a war to get your country back? The first one, I would say, is more patriotic. It is more conservative, and it is addressing, it is how can we conservative win? What would be a good way of winning? It is the most political book out of the three. But then again, it is not it's not what I would call a radical right. It is not something that is encouraging, like, take over the state or to overthrow a state. Quite the opposite, actually, because he wants to fight within the system to get a conservative government. And he mentioned a word like radicalized. He was anything but not like a radical. When it came to politics, he was pretty, well, it was conservative Christian. But he was not a zealot. He was not an extremist in any way. He's been portrayed like this by the people who like felt he could be a threat. And that is interesting, because you mentioned that the FBI took an interest in him. But he really wanted to build a resistance network, and he was advertising, in newspapers, radio shows. I mean, like, a subversive movement that wants to overthrow the government won't pay ads in the newspaper. He really wanted to, recruit people who would be able to defend against, like, an enemy from the outside. That was a mindset, as we mentioned before. So he did it, like, openly. I don't think any, like, subversive, like the Weatherman, like the communist organization that votes to overthrow the government of the United States, they would not recruit, like, openly in newspapers. That's not something.
Right. So he was very transparent in his goals and what his sort of mindset was in general, what the mindset of his organization, the Minutemen, were, as opposed to the radical left, like the, as you mentioned, the Weather Underground. They were very much underground, you know, and secretive and planning their terrorist activities. So yeah, totally different mindset, and that seems pretty typical with, you know, comparing and contrasting the far right and the far left. The far right is always much more honest and transparent about their goals and what they stand for versus the left, it seems like, anyways.
Oh, and yeah, and in this case, like, I wouldn't put the Puig in, like, on the far right, as I said. He was a conservative Christian, the patriot, but he had no, like, extremist view, and he could hardly be called, like, far right.
Yeah, that's interesting that you say that, because he did, in your article, mentions this, and it's mentioned in other books I've read, just about the far right, and, you know, the history of, like, the far right in America in general, how he actually did have conflicts with other right-wing groups, including George Lincoln Rockwell's the American Nazi Party. But you also point out that he did have good working relationships with others, like Willis Carta, who we mentioned, and also Ed Fields, who I know you talked about in your article as well. So that's pretty interesting. But you're saying he was sort of dishonestly smeared as like a white... I know that was a tactic that they regularly used. They were describing these men as white supremacists, when they really weren't at all. They seem to me, and we can talk about like their sort of ideology. They seem much more libertarian, just more skeptical of the government. They very much, you know, valued like individual freedom and independence from central authority. Right, that was kind of more their mindset.
Oh, totally. And your point with the libertarian is very good. Because actually, they were like in the mindset of the Tea Party. And they have been smeared, just like the Tea Party. But I mean, like, they were colorblind. Anybody could join the Minutemen. It was not sectarian, and it would accept, like, anybody who was patriotic. And this is, well, they had no, like, secret agenda, because they had no political agenda at all. Of course, now why they were smeared, they accepted anyone. They did not, like, deny, like, other patriots to join in their organization. And this is how they got people like Ed Fields or people like Willis Carto. They were not like they were not restricted to those people. I mean, like, they were open to anybody from the John Birch Society, from totally apolitical people who would join because they loved their country and feared that one day it might be invaded. So this is like this is why they've been smeared by the Ruffinists.
Okay, so I'm sorry, you're saying that they were smeared because they were open to working with more, like, racialist-type thinkers like Willis Carto or Ed Fields? Because they had, like, associations with them?
They were open to, like, anyone, including people
yeah.
from the racial
yeah.
right.
Well, I mean, they seem... One thing, I never actually got a chance to meet Willis Carto, but just reading about him over the years and hearing others talk about him, he seemed like a very, I mean, he obviously had his views, and he was very principled in them, but he struck me as extremely practical, and he wanted to work with basically everybody who sort of was on the same page, right? I mean, you didn't necessarily have to align totally on all the issues, you know, but, so that sort of seems like how De Puig was as well. He was just practical, right? Working, you know, working
yeah,
in a very... in a very hostile environment when the government is not only targeting you, but demonizing you as, you know, a white supremacist or a potential terrorist. Again, the parallels that we see back then with today, it's the same exact tactics, right, that we see from the media and the government when it comes to covering any sort of right-wing or conservative dissident movement, right? It's the same exact tactics.
Well, nothing has changed since the third... in the 30s. I mean, like, they smeared Ruffinists, and they basically will call him Nazi, a fascist, a white supremacist. Anything that can hurt, publicly speaking, this is, like, it's not something new, and it is something that actually that works. It works, otherwise it would change tactics. But it works, and it has worked since 90 years ago. So basically, yeah, it's been victim of that tactic that we still see around.
Right, exactly. Well, as I mentioned, the group was eventually they were founded, I believe it was 1958. And I think you point that out in your article. Yeah, 1958 they were founded. And eventually the group was targeted by the FBI, as I mentioned. They used informants and I believe even outright like undercover agents, right, to infiltrate the group. Is that
yeah,
correct?
Yeah, they did.
Yeah, and again, the same like exact tactics that we see on display by law enforcement and intelligence agencies today across the Western world. They're doing the same exact thing. Can you talk about how we sort of already mentioned it, like how the group was organized? You know, we sort of explained how it was basically small cells. But can you describe like the – because it was a national organization, right? Can you sort of describe how it was organized across the country? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, it was a national organization based on cells. Basically, it was not a question of secrecy to hide from the government because the government could have the files and who was a member. And this was something pretty easy to get. The government has actually estimated the number like fairly precisely, I would say. Now, how it was organized, there would be a section composed of a few independent cells. And those people, like, if anybody was killed by it, would be able to, like, continue independently their resistance against the enemy. So it was hierarchical, but it was not, it was kind of, very independent as well. The cells were independent one from another. But of course, because it was an organization and there were standards and they needed to go in the same direction, there was the Puig at the top and he would have people at the state to run the state and other, sub-leaders under him all the way to the cells, which would account for a few members.
Right, yeah, no, that all makes sense. And they were organizing camps and conferences and workshops to, you know, not only discuss the threat of communism, but also to talk about survival skills and that sort of thing, correct?
Yeah, totally. That was the basic point. They needed to be able to survive and eventually fight back. So they put a lot of emphasis on getting ready, and getting ready means to be able to do things and to know things. So this is the new who. They also like add an intelligence part, where they gathered information on who was involved in communism, who were the communist, who were the communist agent within the government. So they would know who within the government could betray the United States, who could become a potential enemy one day. So they had that intelligence as well. And this is probably another element that made them like a potential threat to their opponents as a matter of fact.
Interesting. And he also published a newsletter, right, called On Target, that was distributed nationally to subscribe. I would assume to – you didn't necessarily have to be a member of the organization. You could subscribe. It was like a newspaper, right?
Yeah, it was a newsletter more than a newspaper. It was something very small, but it carried a lot of information about the, you know, like the communist threat or how to survive. And it was well, pretty diverse information within that newsletter.
Right. Well, and again, they were targeted as white supremacists by the media and by the government, of course. And as you know, we sort of already explained that that really wasn't their mindset. They really weren't a racialist or like a pro-white organization really at all. Again, they were much more libertarian leaning. In fact, in Blueprint for Victory, you have a quote from him where he says that the Minutemen were not right-wing or left-wing, they were individualists. So there's that sort of, like, libertarian streak, right? That very, sort of like a uniquely, like, American-type mindset, right? Like, very skeptical of the central authority and really wanting to sort of fend for yourself, right? That was kind of the mindset, it seemed like.
Oh, it was very opposed to, like, anything called collectivist. And that is something that really makes, Nazis, like George and Rockwell, the Nazi ideology is something that is a collectivist ideology, and so is fascism. And the Puig was really against, like, any collectivism. So that is a very, very, very important breaking point for many things like Nazi or fascist. And when we think about it, it was in the '50s, and in the '50s, if you remember well, you know, like the Democratic Party in the South was openly racialist. If we think about the Dixiecrats, like the Puig was not a racialist. Otherwise, it would have claimed it. It would have said it. The Democratic Party was racialist at that point, and they were winning elections based on the racialist platform. Most of the South was still segregated. It was not something like you would hide or you would pretend not to be at that period of time if you really were. It's not something that would like gain you anything positive to hide the fact that you were a racialist like, organization if you were, but the Puig was not. Then again, it was from an individualist point of view that it would judge like other people, including when it came to other races. So this is something that needs to be said, because this is something maybe like people around you, they tend to forget, but racialism back then was something pretty open that you could like advocate openly. So people who were not advocating it were not like hiding some beliefs in their closet or anything like that. That makes no sense.
Right. So like if he actually were a racialist, or if he were concerned about like, you know, white people in America, for example, he would be openly saying that, but he didn't. And, you know, that really wasn't his primary concern, or really, it seems like from what I've been able to read, really much of a concern at all, right? I mean, he didn't really conceptualize the world in those terms. It was much more about individual liberty and you know, that sort of streak in the American political tradition.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't think, like, he really was opposed to like anything collectivist, like, and race is a collectivist vision, if you will. So he was opposed to racism, that point of view.
Right. Do you have any idea how many, and you do address this in the article, but I'm just curious, do you have any idea how many total members they had, you know, maybe at their height?
Well, this is a very good question, and right now I do not have the answer like in front of my eyes, and I'm juggling with a lot of numbers because of my book right now, a lot of membership members. I'm not going to be able to answer that question like clearly or precisely enough.
Okay,
but
I know.
Like, it is
It's okay. Yeah, I was going to say, I'm looking at it right here in the article. They say between 5,000 and 6,000, but you sort of suggest that it probably was a lot more than that, because those 5,000 or 6,000 that they counted were, you know, probably like the more hardcore vocal members rather than like the sympathizers, the people that were, you know, involved sort of behind the scenes. So it was a much bigger network than that, I think, is what I'm trying to say.
Oh, yeah, because a lot of people, and this is an important point, because a lot of people would not take any like official role within the organization, and they were not like necessarily encouraged to do so. There was no point like selling like card members or anything. But people, for example, like you've got someone in the neighborhood who would join the Minutemen, then a few of his friends would train with him, and they would like form a cell. But there's no use like the other people like to actually join the movement. It would be as efficient, maybe even more, if they had not joined the movement. So they did not encourage, they tried to recruit, but they did not, like, try to, like, boost their numbers artificially. Their objective is not to have, like, that many rank and file members, but to have, like, a strong network with efficient people.
Right. Well, and another aspect of the traditional, you know, like, American political mindset is the strong support of private gun ownership. This was something that De Puig and the Minutemen were very much concerned about. In fact, it was probably one of the most important aspects of their, you know, their sort of like political agenda was, look, individual citizens need to be able to keep and bear arms free from government intrusion or government interference. And this ultimately, I think anyways, is what led to them being targeted by the FBI. And it's a topic I wanted to get into. And you actually note that the first mistake the Minutemen made, according to De Puig himself, was to start stockpiling weapons as they did. And I wondered if you could maybe elaborate on this, because this obviously was a very important aspect of the organization. In fact, you have a good quote from De Puig who wrote to his fellow followers, hide your weapons away when they were being investigated by the federal government. Hide your weapons away. To surrender your arms is to surrender your liberty and most probably your lives as well. So again, this is something that has always been very, very important to, to American patriots in general, but especially on sort of like the right wing, this reverence for the Second Amendment and for private gun ownership. So you want to talk about his views on private gun ownership in general, and to what extent was their stockpiling of weapons actually illegal? Because it seems like there was a lot of very fishy things going on at the time, and they may have been set up or, something like that. So I'm just curious, what's your take on these issues?
Well, actually, there has been a lot that was said back then about their stockpiling weapons. And I don't think they stockpiled that many weapons, but they were said to have, huge caches full of weapons and everything. I don't think they had that many weapons. But most of the members had a minimum, a few guns, I would say. They would be able to be self-reliant while facing an invading, army. This is basically, the point of Switzerland. If ever there was an army, an incoming army that will break neutrality, Swiss neutrality, then everybody's going to be able to reach for their gun and defend their homeland. That was the point, that the Puig was making at that time. But then when the government started turning hostile against them, they thought, now we not only must hide them, for a potential resistance movement, but we must, hide them in case the government wants to, seize our gun for whatever reason. And this is at a point, where they started to see that the state might be, a potential enemy from within, that the enemy, the communists were already, in power in Washington. So this is why they advocated, hiding and stockpiling weapons. Now, that being said, this is what led the Puig in jail, gun violation. Because, everything that he did was legal, except that he did not follow all the rules on guns. There are plenty of regulations. You cannot cross that and that border with a gun. You cannot own that type of gun within the state, and things like this. And this is how he was eventually, sentenced. He wasn't jailed for huge arsenals or things like this, but for minor violations of gun regulation. So for him, it was a basic right that anyone can defend himself, especially more in times of turmoil. This is when you really need to be, ready. And I mean, at the moment, there's going to be an invasion or there's going to be, a hard situation. It's not going to be the moment to go buy a gun. That's going to be extremely complicated. That's going to be the first thing that you cannot do anymore. That's going to be the first right that you don't have. So if his point was, if you're waiting for big trouble before actually thinking about getting a gun and ammunition, it's going to be too late. At that point, you're not going to have a chance to do it. You'd better do it now, stockpile a lot of ammunition and everything. Be ready. So whenever it happens, whenever there's going to be trouble, you're going to be ready. You already have your guns, and you're going to be able to defend yourself and defend your family and defend your nation as well.
Interesting. Now, what about the accusations of plans to commit bank robberies or to bomb federal buildings and other buildings, basically engage in terrorism? What's your take on these sorts of allegations? Because this is something that was sort of plaguing the organization, particularly towards its tragic end, right?
Oh, it is exactly what brought it down. But now it is again the FBI informant's work, and it is extremely hard to know what really happened. But one thing is clear from the FBI files themselves. Once you take the time to read them, you see that the FBI agent, they realized that most of the people involved in the plan of robbery, it really was only a plan. Nothing happened. No bank was actually robbed. And it's a tip from an informant. An informant actually told him, okay, there's going to be a bank robbery carried on by Minutemen. The FBI agent, like, listens to the informant, and they realize that all the other people involved in a bank robbery were very reluctant to take part in it. So was there, like, really a plan to do a bank robbery? Was it the idea of the informant himself? Was it, you know, this is extremely hard to figure out. And they said, well, you know, the Puig is aware of that. But the Puig was not even involved in that story. They managed to involve him because the informant said that the Puig knew about it. And all those stories about also one of the Puig's associates wanting, because we're still in the want and wish, wanting to bomb the Soviet embassy in Washington, is all based on informants' testimony. There is no hard evidence. Of course, when they cracked down on the members of Minutemen that were, like, supposedly involved in the plot, well, they found weapons. They found weapons and survival things that could be used for a bank robbery. It could be used for a bank robbery or surviving the woods, like, for a year. Basically, they had no... There was no actual evidence except for the informants that were paid.
Boy, doesn't that sound very, very familiar to anybody paying attention to what's going on in America? For example, the plot to kidnap Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer, and that entire thing was literally concocted by FBI informants and undercover agents. The whole entire conspiracy was advanced by the people working for the FBI, and it was, you know, basically designed to frame and to target these individuals. You know, it's just the same thing they were doing back then, same exact tactics. It's outrageous.
It is outrageous, and it is actually extremely frequent in the history of the like right wing movement within the United States. And I get that from the FBI files themselves, and I get that from the parts that are not blacked out, because a lot is blacked out within the FBI files that we can get today. But still, we always understand that it's based on that or a disinformant. And without their testimony, there is no case. They're only, well, you know, like...
Rumors and speculation.
Rumors.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so, I guess just to ask you very straightforwardly, do you think that the Minutemen and Dupuig himself were genuinely involved in any criminal conspiracies or outright criminal activity at any point?
I really doubt it. I really doubt it. Of course, as my historian professor, they were recruiting, like, openly, and they were not, like, hiding anything. Everything that they said, they did. I mean, like, they said, we need to stockpile weapons. We need to be able to go into hiding. And that's exactly what they did. We need to train. So if ever Cuba decides to send, like, invading troops backed by Soviet troops, we're going to be ready to go on the ground. They said it, and they prepared for that eventuality. I really, really doubt that they would go, like, against the Soviet embassy in Washington. And actually, except rumors, nothing in an informant testimony, nothing is, like, backed that claim. And this is extremely important because we have seen in the last few years revisionism within the black nationalist movement. And, I mean, they were talking about, like, Malcolm X's murderer, who were recently, exonerated from, proven, like, innocent. And they targeted the work of FBI informant within the black nationalist movement. And the government agreed that they had used the informant in a very dishonest way, and they knew it. Well, it is the same thing. What happened with the black nationalist movement happened to the white nationalist movement as well. The informant in several groups has played a major role in bringing whole organizations down. Organizations that were perfectly legal, but the FBI with their COINTELPRO program, and even after that, continued to play a very dirty role to bring some organizations down. in a very illegal and immoral way.
Yeah. Oh, exactly. Very illegal, very immoral, very dishonest, very just, I mean, again, outrageous, the, you know, some of the tactics that they were using, which again carry on to this very day. And it seems like the big turning point with the federal government's sort of war on not only the Minutemen, but also other sort of anti-communist type groups was in 1961. It was actually under the JFK administration, the Kennedy administration, that De Puig and the Minutemen really became a target of the federal authorities. And that's when they began actively infiltrating the organization and sort of setting them up with these, you know, ridiculous bank robbery, you know, conspiracy charges or allegations. So it kind of just, it basically went downhill from 1961 when they were highly demonized by the federal government and ultimately infiltrated by federal law enforcement like the FBI. And again, as you said, they were a very transparent, straightforward organization. They were very clear about their goals and objectives and what they were trying to do, none of which was criminal. And, you know, all of which was entirely legitimate and right in line with the traditional American, you know, with traditional American political traditions, I guess, right? I mean, sort of goes to the heart of how this country was founded and what this country represents.
Oh, totally. They had the spirit of frontier, and they also had, like, the spirit of law and order. This is what they wanted to preserve, like, family, law and order. That was, like, what they sought to preserve.
Right, absolutely. Well, did you have any other comments you wanted to make about De Puig? He was obviously a very interesting, a very courageous, a very honorable man, it seems like, in my opinion, anyways. I don't know if I'd necessarily agree. Yeah, no, I was just saying, if you had any other comments you wanted to make about De Puig, I mean, from my perspective, he was a very courageous, a very honorable man. I don't know if I could say I would necessarily agree with his politics, or at least all of the aspects of them. I think he did make a lot of good points, and he did have a very righteous cause. But I'm just curious if you had any, like, sort of concluding thoughts about him or anything you've learned from doing this sort of research into his background.
Well, it's not even a question about, like, if we agree or we disagree with him. And that was not my point, like, in writing this, like, this article. I wrote that article because I thought it was a lot of the, there was a lot of lies being told about him. And, I think, like, people should read that article. And if ever you need to investigate more, go see the FBI file for yourself. Everything is there, like, plainly written, and you're gonna see that the cases against the Puig and his men is clearly not that, like, obvious. It's not like what it's said to be. And I think, like, historians, by just, like, saying, oh, well, they were arrested for that because they really had a plot to the bank robbery and bomb the Soviet embassy, are definitely doing a disservice to the word and to the profession of the historian.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I'm glad that we were able to publish this article in the Barnes Review to sort of set the record straight and to provide an alternative perspective on this very interesting figure in American history, one that is really not well known. I mean, I don't think most people would know who Robert De Puig was or the Minutemen in general. But again, as I said, I think he is a very, very important figure to study, and there's a lot of lessons to be learned. And one of those lessons is that the government is using basically the same exact tactics against any sort of dissident groups, you know, today in the modern age. And I wanted to kind of wrap up and talk about an article you wrote for American Free Press in the most recent issue. This would have been issue 31 and 32. And you talk about this anti-terror operation in Canada, where, you know, the Canadian, I think it was the Royal Mounted Police, that,
exactly.
I believe that's like the equivalent of like the FBI in America, right? Like the federal law enforcement.
It is
in Canada.
The federal police, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And they basically launched this raid on quote unquote neo-Nazis. And it was basically more about projecting fear and state power and hyping the threat of quote unquote white supremacist terrorism and extremism. And you know, it's incredible how synchronized virtually every single Western government is when it comes to not only like the COVID agenda, but the situation in Ukraine, foreign policy towards China, but especially this idea that white supremacists and, you know, right-wing extremists, domestic terrorists, pose the greatest threat to the country, pose the greatest threat to Canada or to the United States, when I can think off the top of my head of 10 different authentic threats facing the country, you know, rather than these like totally hyped and manufactured threats. So do you want to talk about this article before we kind of wrap up? Because I think it really does.
Oh, yeah.
I think it does dovetail well with, you know, some of the lessons that we can learn by studying Robert Dupuig and the militia movement.
Well, actually, it is when you were talking about the fact that it is something that we see worldwide. When Justin Trudeau arrived in power 6 years ago, basically you said it straight. You said, well, the first and like the most important threat we face right now is white supremacism. And I mean, like, it was at that time Islamist terrorism is still at a very high level. And so is, you know, like normal murders, like crime. Crime is on the rise in Canada and is getting like epidemic in some regions. In most big cities now, like murder rate has increased. But basically, the new narrative was white supremacy is all around, and they are trying to like basically kill everyone. So what happened is they decided, like, they made a big crackdown. So they say on neo-Nazi terrorism at the end of June. They basically raided two houses in the countryside in Quebec, two very quiet towns, and we saw like dozens of army-dressed federal agents, and they even had like a light tank. And I mean, it was that bad. They had warned the local police to be ready to for an intervention and to back them up if anything turned wrong. That was the culminating point, like the climax of a two-year investigation into that neo-Nazi ring. So they raided the two houses, and they posted pictures on Twitter, on their Twitter account, something they never do. They do it, like, I mean, very, very, very rarely. But this time, the raids were advertised live while they were performing them. So they raided the two one apartment in a former school turned into a housing unit. Two young men actually were targeted for their involvement on an internet forum. And if you look at it, like if you take the time to look at the pictures, you see them dressed like as soldiers, wearing military guns and snipers with a light tank. And they do like force their way inside the housing. They basically take the guys out and they make them sit on the sidewalk without any supervision, and they continue their raid, and they take a lot of photos of them like entering the battle style. So those 60 men don't even like take a look at the men they just put on the sidewalk, and we read that they were performing a search warrant. That's it. And they found nothing. They found no weapon, nothing illegal. I mean, maybe they took a computer, like hard drive or something like that. But they found nothing illegal. And they came out after and just went back to their HQ. And that was it. Nobody was arrested. No one was ever charged. But the impression was, and is still, that there is a neo-Nazi ring. And there's a neo-Nazi threat. Like, white supremacists are getting involved in terrorism in Quebec, which is like totally crazy. But they hyped it so much that a lot of people actually buy it. But as I said, the two men who were being searched were not even handcuffed. They just were sitting there on the sidewalk waiting for the search warrants to be conducted.
Wow. Yeah, well, it doesn't surprise me. I mean, we see very similar tactics on display in the United States and other Western European countries. In fact, there was actually just a letter released by Republican Representative Jim Jordan, who has been interviewing FBI whistleblowers, and he's been told that some of these people were basically being pressured to reclassify cases as quote-unquote domestic violent extremism, even if the cases don't even meet that sort of criteria, basically for political purposes. to sort of advance this narrative coming from the Biden administration, coming from the mass media, that, you know, domestic extremists pose the greatest threat to the country. And by that, they basically mean white, quote-unquote white supremacists or white patriots, or just conservative political dissidents in general. They basically classify everybody as sort of like a white supremacist extremist nowadays. So it's extremely similar all across the Western world. And again, shows the sort of coordination that all of these governments are basically on the same page with their talking points on all of these key issues, it seems like.
Oh, they are definitely on the same page. Biden and Trudeau totally agree on that. And as a matter of fact, you know, Canada has been a pioneer in this field. I mean, like, we have put, like, the Proud Boys on the terrorist, like, organization list. So, I mean, like, it is totally illegal in Canada to promote the Proud Boys, because you'd be promoting a terrorist organization. And when you read, well, when you read the law, you can face jail time for doing so. But they do admit that it's not because they have committed anything like criminal or remotely violent. But they are tagged, like officially tagged, legally tagged as a white supremacist, like terrorist organization, which is a nonsense. But you see, nobody, like, when that comes out, when they decide to label an organization as a neo-Nazi terrorist organization, nobody wants to go and defend their rights, you know, because nobody wants to be defending a terrorist neo-Nazi organization. So everybody shuts up, and the government can have its way, and continue doing so. And this is a major problem. And it's not even about, like, what is legal and illegal at that point. It really is about, like, people are scared of the media. They're scared of ostracism. They're scared of, like, everybody, like, looking at them like as they were neo-Nazi terrorists themselves because they defend other people's freedoms.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's a disgrace, and again, it's something we see across the Western world. I actually haven't been paying too much attention to Justin Trudeau, who is probably one of the most despicable politicians I've ever come across. And I mean, Biden's up there, but Justin Trudeau is one of the worst. And I was just looking on his Twitter feed before we started the podcast, just to see like what he was talking about, what he was tweeting about. And let me just give you a couple examples. He's tweeting about how Canada is recommitting to preserve the memory of the Roma people during the Holocaust, murdered by the evil Nazis. That's something he's been tweeting about today. He's announcing more sanctions against Russia and its illegal invasion of Ukraine. So it's basically like reinforcing the official narrative of World War II, demonizing Russia, those sorts of things. The same thing we see from Biden and pretty much all the other Western leaders. He was talking about the murder of Al-Zawahiri, the guy that they tell us was just taken out in a CIA drone strike in Afghanistan, said to have been behind 9/11, which is laughable. It's funny to me that people would even take any of this seriously, considering all we know about 9/11 today. And also, he's tweeting about the painful history of slavery in Canada. I didn't realize Canada had a history of slavery. I mean, I thought that was kind of reserved to the United States and to South America. But Trudeau is out there tweeting about the painful history of slavery in Canada and how he's celebrating the strength of black communities and, you know, this sort of nonsense that we see on display across the Western world. So anyways, I thought that was interesting. I haven't been paying too much attention to Trudeau, but you go to his Twitter feed and there he is hitting all the globalist talking points, right?
Oh, I mean, like, he did one thing and he's setting the narrative. I mean, like, last month he was apologizing to, black Canadians for not having treated them as hero after the First World War. So he officially apologized to, black veterans from the First World War. And I mean, like, all of this is nonsense. All of this makes no sense. I mean, they were not, like, discriminated against. It's just that they did not have, they were not treated as heroes when it came back. I mean, we talked about, like, French Canadians. I mean, like, we have to serve in a different language, in the British Army that had, like, put fire, one, like, conferred us. I mean, we had to go against our will to Europe, to fight, but that is not, it's not important to him. What is important is when the Black Regiment came back, there was like no flower, nobody took up to them with a parade or anything like that. But that was like usually racist, and Canada has to whip its back once again. Well, there's always a thing, and I'm very curious if one day we're going to stop finding like things to apologize about. If one day we're just going to be able to say, well, okay, yeah, we've apologized about like everything from the cold climate here to having too many trees to having this and that. I don't know if one day we're going to be able to like just stop.
I think it's, I frankly think it's probably going to be a never ending scam. that's the way it's going.
Yeah, you're right. It works,
man. Yeah. Well, Remy, thank you very much. We'll go ahead and wrap up. That was a great conversation. Thank you so much for taking the time. I really do appreciate it. And your article was excellent in the Barnes Review, the most recent issue, the July-August 2022 edition. Once again, I'd encourage everybody to check out the Barnes Review and become a subscriber if you're not already. The website is barnesreview.org. And, of course, also check out AmericanFreePress.net, America's last real newspaper, which you also contribute to. And, yeah, thanks, man. I really appreciate it. We'll do this again in the future.
Well, thank you very much for having me over. And I'm sorry for the accent. You know, we French Canadians have a terrible accent. I know it. I'm aware of that.
Hey, no problem. No problem at all, man. I appreciate it. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Goodbye. Okay, talk to you soon.